You're listening to Culture with Robert Bound, first broadcast on the 4th of November 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the 108th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Boom, bing, bang, we've got a sack full of audio delectation for you this time around, a bag full of treats. Sometimes I think we need a wheelbarrow rather than a radio show. It's not a rag bag, it's a handsome weekend holdall, weathered and peppered with stickers from all the places it's seen on its travels, always with a microphone in hand. Here's what we've got. That sprightly architect of modern cultural spaces, Alex Lifschutz, gives us a tour of his reboot of Bonham's The Auctioneers.
An auction house is somewhere between a warehouse and a theatre, a retail emporium and a sort of working space for people who are expert in various different arts. So you have to find a different way to approach the traditional topic of, well, how do I set up an exhibition?
We'll get set adrift on Memory Bliss with a visit to something I bet you didn't even know existed, Taiwan's premier jazz festival.
It is not our music, but the very spirit of jazz will touch everybody.
I'll enjoy one of our best ever Midori House sessions. A sultry one it was too, courtesy of Brazilian pop princess Thais Gulin.
He wanted to do like this beginning like cinema americano with those pearls and then when he breaks to the Sir Mix-a-Lot song, it goes trash pop.
We'll also hear from folk rock flame keepers Midlake on their slimmed down lineup and their lovely new record. We'll hear from the creator of one of the most iconic British TV shows of the 80s, Spitting Image, and sit down for a screening at a new independent cinema in Barcelona. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First up, music time, and this week we made the Caipirinhas for a packed performance space here at Midori House. Packed why? Packed to see Brazilian singer Thais Gulin, described by the LA Times magazine as someone who could break your heart from 50 paces. She was recently on tour with her band across Europe, and she stopped by to see us. Here she is with Cinema Big Butts.
Tão homem, tão bruto, tão Coca-Cola, nego. Tão rock and roll, tão bomba atômica, tão amedrontado, tão burro, tão desesperado. Tão jeans, tão centro, tão cabeceira, tão Deus. Tão raiva, tão guerra, tanto comando e adeus. Tão indústria, tão nosso, tão falso, tão Papai Noel. Tão Oscar, tão triste, tão chato, tão ONU e Nobel. Tão hot dog, tão câncer social. Tão narciso, tão quadrado, tão fundamental. Tão bom, tão lindo, tão livre, tão Nova York. Tão grana, tão macho, tão western. Tão ibope, racistas, paternalistas, acionistas. I like big butts and I cannot lie. Your other brothers can deny. When a girl walks in with an itty bitty waist and a mouth in your face, you get strong. When I pull off tough, cause I noticed that butt was stuffed. Deep in the jeans she's wearing, I'm hooked and I can't stop staring. Oh baby, I wanna get with ya and take a picture. My homies try to warn me that butt you've got. Ooh, rumble smooth skin. You say you wanna get in my bands? Well, use me, cause we the average groupie. I see them dancing to hell with romancing. She's fat, wet, gotta go like a turbo vet. I'm tired of magazines saying flappers are the thing. Take the average black man and ask him that. She's gotta pack much back. So fellas, fellas, if your girlfriend got the butt, shake it, shake it, shake the healthy butt. Baby got back. Baby got back. Prefiro os nossos sambistas. Prefiro o poeta pálido, anti-homem que ri, que chora. Que lê Rambo Verlaine, que é frágil, que te adora. Que entende o triunfo da poesia sobre o futebol. Mas que joga sua pelada todo domingo debaixo do sol. Prefere ao invés de Slayer ouvir Caetano, ouvir Mano Tchau, não quiser, não seja legal. E visceral, a expressão do desespero do macho americano é normal. Esse medo da face fêmea dita por Cristo é natural. É preciso mais do que um soco pra se fazer um som, um homem, um filme. É preciso seu amor, seu feminino, seu swing. pra ser bom de cama é preciso muito mais do que um pau grande. É preciso ser macho, ser fêmea, ser elegante. Pa 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 pa. Prefiro os nossos sambistas.
That was Thijs Gullin performing Cinema Big Butts for us here at Midori House. You know the form. More from her later on in the show. Right, from Brazil, we come back now to the streets of London. Auctioneers Bonhams have a proud history, but have had a stuffy image compared to their competitors. Under a new boss, Robert Brooks, the august house is pulling itself up by the bootstraps and showing a bit of leg in the process, if their beautiful new HQ on London's New Bond Street is anything to go by. On a crisp and clear autumn day, I was given a tour by the architect Alex Lifschutz, who's gutted and rethought what was once a warren of carpet, low ceilings and interminable corridors, to make a light, airy and fairly spectacular space to view and buy art, jewellery and wine. Hell, even classic racing cars too. Through that fairly unassuming front door we strode. Here's the tour.
The first thing you might notice is that this is one of the narrowest facades in Bond Street, number 101. Very elegant Edwardian building, probably 3 or 4 metres wide. And I hope you'll get a surprise when you go in, because from being the narrowest, it becomes the grandest as you walk through the door.
Oh, wow. It is huge already inside. I guess this is a floor to the very top story, kind of atrium right at the front of the building.
Yes, we've taken every floor of this building out, so it's about it's just under 20 metres high. It's a very elegant, slender atrium. It's a light fitting, effectively. It's a lantern on the street. We can light it, as you can see, on every story. These light fittings, linear light fittings that are concealed, shine light upwards, and we can change the colour. We can create a really magical effect on the street.
This is quite amazing. It's not an unpromising doorway, but it is a narrow one, and this is quite an amazing space to walk into.
Well, just to say, just before we move on, we can also exhibit things in that space. So we can have Formula One cars racing down the walls. We can have objects hung up there. And there's anchoring points that allow us to carry great weight. So it's a space that can be curated, that can actually have some excitement in it, not just the space itself.
You've got immediately a pleasant danger of a lot of people banging into each other in the hallway there as they look upwards, right? I suppose that's kind of the aim of the architect, to inspire a bit of awe as well as to be usable, I suppose.
Well, it's always the thing is to create a little bit of magic and to turn weakness into strength, to turn a very narrow, as I say, a very narrow and unpromising approach into something that inspires you.
And now here we are in what you'd probably regard as the regular hallway. We've got some navy dressing on the walls, and we've actually got some paintings in here. This is looking a little bit more like an auction house.
Well, we're in the Bond Street sale room, which is quite a grand sale room. You can see about 6 metres high, over 20 metres long and 15 metres wide, of that sort of proportion. Very classic shaped room with a variety of different objects on show here to show. This is the sort of opening event exhibition to show the different types of things that Bonham sell, from the Fragonard, which we're passing on the right, which is going to go for upwards of 17 to 20 million, to wine at £80,000 a case on the left. So a lot of different things shown here.
We are here in this sort of main hallway, which it's a sort of greatest hits of the stuff that Bonhams sells. It's a sort of broad array of stuff. Is that a bit of a challenge as an architect as well, having to, as you said, when we walked into the atrium, the opening atrium, have to incorporate potentially racing cars for sale as much as paintings and wine?
Well, and Bonhams have a speciality in selling bits of space rocket as well. So we
bits of space rocket, is that a specialty? Well, that's the nichest of niches.
Well, that was the first exhibition I saw in there. So bits of NASA's old kit. So things become collectible in a way that is unpredictable. So these are very versatile spaces. I think one of the challenges, and very interesting challenge, is how to make a space which can be lit in entirely different ways. And we'll go down to Sail Room 1 in a second. You'll see a large piece of modern art, modern West African art, displayed in a completely different way in the same sort of space, again with daylight, but completely different environment. It's a space that's sort of pregnant with possibility. We are exactly underneath the other sail room, and it's another double height space, again 6 meters high. This time, instead of the purple, the dark purple colour, which is the sort of Bonham's livery, we have white, and this has been done overnight, so we've overfelted the walls in white. The lighting on the soffit is a delicate pink to chime with the painting, which is a fantastic piece by a Ghanaian artist called El Anatsui.
And it's an interesting thing I wanted to ask you. You said that you'd done an overnight sort of refurb of this room, or restructuring or overhanging of the existing wall colour. That's a big thing that happens in auction houses a lot. Rooms are made temporary, rooms have movable walls, the lighting scheme, all the rest of it to accommodate specific works. Is that something you have to obviously build in right at the beginning of a refurb, right?
Yes, and we sort of rehearsed all the different scenarios with the staff here, who are fantastically skilled at changing the scenario for each, as you say, for each sale. They have to be able to do it. It's a very interesting format. An auction house is somewhere between a warehouse and a theatre, obviously a retail emporium and a sort of working space for people who are expert in various different arts. So you have to find a different way to approach the traditional topic of, well, how do I set up an exhibition? In a normal gallery, the exhibition is set up once for, say, 3 months or at least a few weeks. Here, it's set up for a couple of days. So everything has to be done double quick and very beautifully. So we've got lighting, the latest LED lighting. We've got these vaults above us, which can be backlit also. But all of that has to be adjusted and redirected within a space of a few hours. And we have special kit that allow the staff here to go up the 6 meters to do all of that.
So we're in one of the specialist rooms in the jewellery department.
It's a specialist room, an interview room for any item that you want to bring. You come here to Bonhams with your precious heirloom. You come up to the interview rooms here and you meet an expert. There's a white glove moment, possibly, depending upon how precious it is, whereupon you're given some idea of the price and when the next sale is and so on.
This is a very clinical space. I'm wondering whether it might be a rubber glove moment.
Potentially a rubber glove moment, potentially, depending upon, as I say, the object. It might be an objet trouvé, in which case rubber gloves may be extremely valuable. This is the top sale room, sale room 2, and it's more directed towards smaller objects, so it's about 4.5 meters high, and it's ideal for ceramics and watches, jewellery, the smaller objects.
We've got the navy blue fabric on the walls again. This feels like it's a place for objets rather than statement pieces, perhaps.
Yes, but at the touch of a button, and I'm at a button at the moment.
He's at a sort of tablet console on the wall.
We can change the colour of light. You'll see this was decked out for a party on opening night with lots of sort of disco lighting, and here we go. We can get disco lighting, as you can see.
The technicians are unmoved by your display.
The technicians will become moved in a second. Saturation up. So there you go.
So this feels almost like daylight now in here.
Yeah, we can dial up daylight. And of course, that's important with jewellery when you're showing gems and so on, that you get the right light.
It's the world's slowest disco. That's what I like about it. I'm lulled. It's a sort of lullaby.
I'm the world's slowest disco operator, obviously.
That was architect Alex Lifschutz from Lifschutz Davidson Sandilands, walking and talking us through his ingenious and beautiful refurb for Bonhams on New Bond Street, right here in the centre of the UK's art world. Next, Rog. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Midlake are a band who, for three albums, have been synonymous with a certain sort of high-quality, plaid-fancying, campfire-harmonising folk rock that owed as much, perhaps, to heroes of that genre like Neil Young, as well as progenitors of prog like Genesis. So far, so up my street. But all wasn't quite so rosy in the Midlake Garden. Founder member and lead singer and songwriter Tim Smith announced his departure, but the rest regrouped, literally, and rewrote and recorded an album of fresh material called Antiphon, which is out this week. Eric Pulido and Mackenzie Smith from the band stopped by to tell me all about it.
We had recorded actually for about 2 years. We got right to work after we had toured The Courage of Others. Mm. And so we started working on new material. And for lack of a better term, we were jamming a lot as a band. And Tim had actually retreated some to write while we were kind of jamming and writing in more musical ways to try to balance some different processes going on and maybe come up with material that way. And we did. We came up with a lot of stuff in those ways. And obviously worked on it, and it's like we'd take a step forward, take two steps back, and it was always a process like that. So it was kind of par for the course, you know, for us. But long story short, you know, after 2 years of it, you know, Tim didn't want to go any further and didn't want to see it through, and decided that he would step away, and we didn't want to put it down or quit.
Yeah,
But at the same time, the material that we had worked on and created was with Tim. And if we were going to do something further, even though we didn't know for sure at the time, we wanted to do that on our own. So that's what we did. We wrote and recorded a new record in 6 months.
And Antiphon is the response. Mackenzie, I wanted to bring you in because before we switched the mics on, we were talking about the sound of Antiphon, the new record. It sounds different. It sounds kind of, it's got a bit of a cleaner sound maybe to it, or it's got a percussive element to it. It's got a drive to it maybe that the other albums not exactly haven't lacked, but it sounds more rocky. You're the percussion king in Midlake, so you can tell us about how you laid these tracks down.
I think there was a shift in general direction. Obviously, sonically, we wanted to do something rather than try to imitate or become, you know, be the same Midlake that people have known us as, because we are a band, you know, everybody has contributed a ton of work, a ton of creative ideas to this band over the years. And we were in a different chapter now. Somebody who'd been a huge part of the band is now not there. And so that was sort of a challenge and an inspiration to us to kind of not have to. We'd sort of been facilitating a lot of Tim's vision for so many years. And instead of doing that now, it was kind of collectively figuring out what is our vision now.
Veil, which is an instrumental track, was actually the first thing recorded, and it was recorded while Tim was in the band in one of our jam sessions of a song that was actually lent itself to become something
else. I think
it
was recorded in January of 2011. I mean, it was right after we'd ended the last record cycle, and we started getting in the studio. I mean, it was that month. It was right away.
One of the first things was the song Provider. And what was cool about that song is, well, Tim and I both were writing solo material at the time when we were doing the band and we were going to make a Midlake record. He was going to make a solo record. I was going to make a solo record. And Provider was one of the songs that I had had for a solo record. So we started working on that. And what was cool about that song is that the band helped it to become a much better song, and we were able to almost use that, I think, as a
bit of a springboard for the rest of the record.
Exactly, and say, okay, how do we want to take this song in its more stripped version and produce it more, you know?
Time will have warranted all that the foliage brung. Falls to the ground at the feet of the old and the young.
One of the things that I loved about the process of recording this album was a pattern that we had gotten into all the years of recording in Midlake, where instead of recording finished songs, we were recording the demo to make sure that the demo was good enough, that the songs was there, and then we would try to go recreate that, and it was always missing a little bit of life.
Yeah.
And so we were trying to work harder than you get in, down this rabbit trail of, well, is the chorus not good enough? Is the what's going on? Maybe the drum part's wrong, maybe the vocal's wrong, but whatever. And after 10, 12, 15, 20 versions of the song, you've basically zapped it of its life.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And so this record, we brought it, Eric would bring in a song and we'd say, okay, this is a solid idea. How do we make this better? Let's everybody put their heads together. Let's come up with something and contribute. And then pretty soon after that, when it started taking shape and becoming something that everyone was kind of nodding their head and saying, okay, now it's starting to sound like something, we pretty much started trying to record the song then and there that way that had a lot of life and freshness, and we hadn't rehearsed the song for 2 months or
yeah,
it was just almost just like, yeah, here's the song and here's the final version. We're not going to look back. I mean, we can come back in a month and kind of check it, and then if there's missing some, then we can start adding some stuff. But there was definitely energy in this recording process.
There you have it. Midlake's Antiphon is out now. It's very good. It's got an autumnal vibe about it that might be up your street if you're in the Northern Hemisphere at this time of year. You're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Where else would we be going next but a Taiwanese jazz festival?
Join Monocle's editors every weekday at 8 a.m. for The View from Midori House. We'll be setting the day's agenda with special guests in the studio and from our bureaus around the world.
The opposition needs to identify the key message to deliver to their niche. And their niche is the 60% of the population who's voting for Korea right now.
We'll check in with our editors on the road, whether they're snowbound or sun-kissed. And of course, we'll still have the focus on music, media and the arts that you've come to expect. That's Midori House, every weekday at 8 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. For 9 days each October, the people of the central Taiwanese city of Taichung congregate every night in the grassy central civic square to enjoy a free festival celebrating all things jazz. The Taichung Jazz Festival started 11 years ago as part of a wider cultural event which also featured literature, painting and traditional Chinese opera. But when the jazz musicians stole the show, they earned the right to claim it as their own. It's now one of the biggest events of its kind in Asia and has become the core of the city's cultural calendar. But what impact does the international prestige of the festival have on Taichung, not exactly one of the biggest cities in the region? And more importantly, does the strength of this one cultural event have the power to change Taichung's image? Chris Fitch popped along to Civic Square to get a taste of the jazz.
The unmistakable sound of live jazz from Taiwanese band Timeless Fusion Party. With their jazz pop instrumental fusion, they are one of a number of musicians tapping into a rising passion for jazz music across Asia at an event which is doing exactly the same. The 2013 Taichung Jazz Festival is in full swing, and the residents have swarmed to the city centre to get a piece of the action. Watching from the side of the main stage is Daniel Shen, music director of the festival since its inception in 2003.
I know jazz is a universal language. I think everybody, even we're Asian, jazz is not our music. But I think the power of the music, the improvisations, just like life. We take different paths to approach our goals in life. That's just like jazz. We took our path and we improvise it and we reach our goal. So I think it is not our music, but the very spirit of jazz will touch everybody.
Historically, he may be right, but if the Taichung Jazz Festival is anything to go by, it seems the Taiwanese have embraced jazz in all its forms. Something which Daniel and the organisers of the festival attempt to provide for with the wide-ranging selection of artists performing at the festival.
Free jazz, avant-garde, bebop, big band, swing, cool jazz. Of course, we have dozens of bands each year, and we try to provide them maybe half, 50% of real, pure jazz. And the other 50% maybe some funky music, some blues, something like rhythm and blues, something, anything just jazz related.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, as it may go from the United States of America, Butterscotch!
One of the festival headliners is singer-songwriter Butterscotch.
There's so many people out tonight, you know, it's... And I mean, I couldn't even see like half of them, you know?
Sporting a blonde curly Mohican, it doesn't take long to realise that Butterscotch isn't your everyday jazz musician. There aren't many jazz performers who produce music quite like this. I think you've introduced to them the idea of beatbox jazz.
That's funny, I've never really heard beatbox jazz, that term before, but I guess that's what I do, yeah.
It's a twist on jazz which goes down very well with this overwhelmingly youthful crowd in Taichung, and the surprisingly high number of fresh faces cheering back at her as she performs is a fact not lost on Butterscotch.
It's crazy because, I mean, in America you have jazz festivals, but it's largely an older audience. But over here there's a lot of young people, and that's really inspiring. People are very loyal over here, and they really pay attention to what you're singing, what you're doing, and they're just very just caring.
This festival is not only for Taichung people, it's for the whole Taiwan. They already know, most of the time they already know what is jazz, and they know how to appreciate it.
Despite this unifying force, to think that the festival could take place anywhere else in the country would mean ignoring the work put in by the organisers to weave the festival into the fabric of the city's identity. This is still an event in the process of evolution, or at least that is how Daniel Shen would like to see it.
We would like to make the Taichung Jazz Festival become maybe one of the biggest jazz festivals in Asia. This festival was getting recognized by the international players. So my most big ambition is to maybe organize the whole Asia, maybe the Chinese circle, like Taiwan, like Hong Kong, like mainland China. We can have a circle, like the jazz festival around this time. We have in Taiwan, in Hong Kong, in Macau, in Shanghai, in Beijing. Maybe something like this will happen in the future, yeah.
If that is the case, and fingers crossed, what does that do for the image of Taichung? How much bigger does it become as a city?
I think it's growing. I mean, it's growing by itself. What we try to do is just help this city to grow a certain kind of image. Maybe make other people from the other country, like foreigners, I would like to make them think that Taichung is an international city. Well, like Hong Kong, we have different kind of cultures mixed together, and we have not just only Taiwanese traditional stuff, but also everything from the world. And jazz maybe is the beginning of this.
Without a doubt, given Taichung's position as the third city in Taiwan, it has a very long way to go to be seen on the same level as Hong Kong. And whether the Jazz Festival could make any difference to this rebrand remains to be seen. But this year's event is definitely creating a feel-good factor among plenty of locals who attended the festival. Amber Chen is a teacher from the southern city of Kaohsiung, who moved to Taichung 5 years ago. She feels the festival is showing the best of her adopted home.
The Jazz Festival lets our feel the Taichung the best, because always we can hear jazz around the world. Come from America, Japan, and Taiwan. So we're proud, very proud in Taichung.
For Monocle in Taichung, I'm Chris Fitch.
Thanks, Chris. And the festival has wrapped up for this year, but if you want to find out more, just visit taichungjazzfestival.com.tw. It's not over yet. Still to come, we have more Brazilian beauty from Thaís Gulin. We'll meet one of the creators of the greatest satirical comedy puppet TV show of all time. Guess what that is? And thought Spanish cinemas were in decline? Think again. We'll be queuing up for tickets at Barcelona's newest independent screen. Be that for a way to spend the next 25 minutes. So music is on the menu first, and back to this week's Midori House session from the talented and harmonious Thaís Gulin. It was a Brazilian doubleheader after the show when she sat down to talk to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. But first, here she is with Alicim Alice.
I'm here on tour. We started at Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, and then Frankfurt, and then London at Ronnie Scott's Bar, and then Madrid, and now we are back.
And you're playing songs from your latest album. How do I pronounce that?
Oh.
It's a very kind of Brazilian sound, no?
Yeah.
And you had this amazing new song, which is kind of some sort of remix of Cinema Americano, which is a song of your album. And it's called Cinema Big Butts. Tell us, where did you came with this idea?
I lived in the United States when I was 15. I studied at the high school. And I loved this song. And one day I decided to sing it somewhere. And during the rehearsal, I was singing Cinema Americano, and then there was a pause, a musical pause, and it came, and the band came with it, and the lyrics are so opposite and close at the same time.
What about the video? It's quite an interesting, for those who haven't seen it, it's a great video. Please type Cinema Big Butts, and can you tell us a little bit more about the video?
Yeah, the video was directed by Gringo Cardia. He's this great guy in Brazil. He wanted to do like this beginning, like Cinema Americano, American cinema, with those pearls and everything like exaggerated. And then when it breaks to the Sir Mix-a-Lot song, it goes trash pop and colorful. And I find it funny because it wouldn't be normal for me to do that.
I can see in your album, you're very influenced by the city of Rio, for example, and the music styles, but you're not from Rio.
No, I'm from south, from Curitiba. My mom was born in Vila Isabel. It's the same district as Cartola, the legendary samba composer. But my dad didn't let me go to Rio until I was like 16 or 17. So I was born with this idea, and we see Rio by the TV all the time. So when I was little, I used to tell my uncles that I would live in Rio. I don't know when it began.
You worked as an actress as well, Thais, right?
Yes.
Did you start it as an actress or as a singer?
I started as a singer. I was 17, but I was 18 when I started as an actress. I even studied at Manchester City College.
What are kind of your next projects? I've heard that, are you working with Elsa Soares by any chance?
I participated at her concert last year. I would love her to record one of my songs, but we don't have anything planned yet. But I have a DVD now, a recording in January, and then the next CD.
That was Thais Gullin talking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thais has finished her European tour for now, but thaisgullin.com.br is when you can keep up to date on all her movements and that new record she was talking about right there. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Graphic designers from across the world gathered in London last month for the Alliance Graphique Internationale London Open. Typographers, book designers and graphic artists from the music and film industries descended on the city's Barbican Centre to gauge the temperature of graphic design today. Giving a talk at the event was Roger Law, co-creator of iconic political TV satire Spitting Image, who indulged the audience with the tale of his journey from jobbing artist to renowned caricaturist and scourge of Britain's political class. Spitting Image was a show which dominated British TV in the 1980s and 1990s, known best for its caricatures of such political figures as Margaret Thatcher, Tony Blair, and even the Queen.
What can I say to Canada?
What about Merry Christmas, Canada?
Bit short, isn't it? What about Dear Canada? Hope you're well. Thanks for putting up the kids this year. Merry Christmas, love, Queenie.
A bit informal at the end, isn't it? What about your head of state? The boss, the big G.
Merry Christmas, love, Liz the Queen. How's that?
A work of literary genius, dear.
Spitting Image was defined by its acute rudeness and acerbic humour and redefined how the Punch and Judy of Westminster and its politicians would be remembered by the public. Unfortunately for them, Monocle's Alid John caught up with Roger Law backstage at the Barbican to look back at his life and work.
Oh, no. Get out! Get out!
But surely, comrade, some small task. Gardening, perhaps, or maybe I could shine your trousers.
This home is for ex-prime ministers only, not for failures like you. Get out!
We must...
I went to art school, obviously. I went to Cambridge School of Art and could draw reasonably well. And Peter Cook, the satirist from Beyond the Fringe, was at university, and he pinched my girlfriend, and I got to know him. I became a satirist. He had a club called the Establishment Nightclub, which was in Soho, and Lenny Bruce worked there, a whole bunch of other comedians. And that's really where my work went off in that direction. But it probably would have done, because I like a laugh, you know.
What is it about caricature that satirists such as yourself, ones that use art specifically as in graphic art, that you're drawn to? Why does it lend itself so well to satire?
Because it takes the piss out of people, and if you do it well, you can tell an awful lot from a caricature.
Who threw this gentleman out the window? It was you, wasn't it?
No, no, he was.
The rule of this house is be kind to all. Now, eat your soup immediately.
I don't like caricatures that are just distorted, just to distort. It should carry some kind of what your idea of the truth about the person is. And if you get it right, it's recognised by the people that look at it. But you have to get it right. And if you get it right, then people retain that image. I mean, Spitting Image, they had an election, and on the front page of the Sunday Times, they just used pictures of the puppets instead of politicians. It came through my door. I read it over a cup of coffee, and I was looking at it for 30 seconds before I realised it was the puppets, and I made them. So, you see, it worked on me, and it worked for other people.
There is a fly in my soup.
How did you conceive the idea of Spitting Image? Was it a kind of serendipitous moment between the politics of the day being particularly striking to you?
You probably gathered from the lecture that, you know, I'm a fairly extreme sort of person in the way that I do things. And our work, in a way, suited the period. And the only thing that we ever did that I'm really quite pleased with, proud of, is we took the cartoon from print to another medium, television. It was the first editorial cartoon that had a half an hour television show. I didn't understand what I'd done. I knew nothing about television. We didn't know that to make a program where everything was handmade and the program was topical, that reacted to the news, was a really bad idea for television. We didn't know that. John Lloyd, who did not the 9 o'clock news and Blackadder, was the producer, and he didn't enlighten us. And then when suddenly we're in this situation of having to produce this show every week, and sometimes they'd throw out half the show on a Friday, have to be reshot on a Saturday, go on a Sunday. I mean, before we got on top of it and had enough puppets. And some shows I worked on, the second half was being edited as the first half went out. You got adrenaline glands like pineapples. You asked me what the pain was moving from print to television.
The challenge.
And I'm telling you, that was it. Because television is basically talking heads. You'll be very lucky to meet anybody with any aesthetic interest in what it looks like, unless you get into drama or film. So you're all the time trying to retain the production values of the work we did in print for television. It was a difficult one. But then you have to put against that, to be positive, is that we never had 15 million people looking at our caricatures in magazines. Even if we got in a magazine with a large circulation for those days, you're talking 2 million, not 15. So you could make the statements you wanted and have quite a large audience. Now, that's a good vehicle. And we were as rude as we possibly could be. And it did change things. We've become more like America since Thatcher passed through. And that was the general idea. Maybe young people recognise the politicians that were in positions of power, like they don't know who they are these days. With Spitting Image, they did. That was a constructive thing.
We talked a lot about Spitting Image. That was a fair old time ago now. Mm. You have lived abroad, you've lived in Australia, spent a lot of time in China. Was it also a question of you taking a break from what I'm guessing was quite a strong spotlight on your work for a time in the UK at least?
Well, absolutely. The last job I did was for the grandson of the first person I ever worked for. And I thought, this has got to stop, you know. And I'd done over 500 caricatures that I worked on, you know. And I did 7 years with Peter Fluck before Spitting Image. Enough's enough. The attraction of China was that I had a workshop again without having to make Spitting Image. So I had a workshop not dissimilar, the hours they work in China. And I could afford to fail.
Because no one knew who you were?
No, no, no. You could try stuff out. And if it failed, it failed. It was no big deal. What you've got now is everything's got a budget, everything's a profit centre. You have to do the work and deliver by Wednesday. That's how it is.
Roger, thank you very much indeed.
I'm ready to see you now, Mom.
That was Roger Law, creator of Spitting Image, speaking to Anid John. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24, from iconic TV to a new Spanish cinema next. Me gustaría una palomita saladas, por favor. Guess what that means.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delaunay.
From Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dana.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're finishing the show today with a trip to the cinema in that great city of Barcelona. A new independent screen has flung open its doors in the city, offering an antidote to the multiplex monopoly and bucking the trend in a nation where many cinemas are feeling the pinch of tax hikes, subsidy cuts and increasingly frugal distributors. Zoom 6 Cinema is in Barcelona's Hostafrancs neighbourhood, and it hopes to reinvigorate audiences with a carefully curated selection of independent titles. Owner Esteban Barnatas has set out to resurrect some old gems from the past, but also support the rousing narratives of today, inviting the audience into the cinema's bistro after the credits roll to continue the discussion with the filmmakers well into the night. Our man in Spain, Liam Aldous, sat down with Esteban between showings.
We try to make our spectators feeling they are in a different place than just to watch a film. So we don't think them like consumers of films.
I'm in the brand new, somewhat ambitious and unashamedly eccentric small Zoom 6 cinema talking to owner Esteban Barnatas. He's telling me about some of the cinemas around the world which inspired him to open up his own in Barcelona.
I have two examples of new cinemas. One is in DF, Mexico. It's called Tonalá, Cine Tonalá, and it's kind of same formula. But also in Los Angeles, I think there's a place called Cine Family who are really active and really trying to offer something else than just to watch a film.
I have to admit that for me, one of my favorite parts of watching films sometimes is the conversation after the film, mm-hmm. and talking about the film. But mm-hmm. when I go to megaplexes, big cinemas, it's kind of alienating because you just go to the movie and you're kind of shunned out onto the street. So how important is having a bar and having a place to really talk and meet after the film for Zoom 6?
We have only one screen here and the bistro, the bar. I prefer to have this formula than maybe two screens and not bar, you know?
Well, by definition, privatization undercuts democracy. Takes something out of the public arena and puts it into the hands of unaccountable private tyrannies that are created and supported by the state.
One of the ways Esteban is drawing in the crowds is by inviting the directors, producers, and writers to chair discussions after the screenings. The cinema has the air of a permanent film festival and is genuinely trying to engage its audience by daring them into a dialogue.
Three filmmakers passed through the Zoom 6 last 2 weeks. So filmmakers, but also producers, at the end of the month, we're going to project the documentary Durruti. That's a 99 film directed by Jean-Louis Comolli. That's a very good French filmmaker. But this film has been produced in Barcelona by a producer, a very good producer. But the film has been only broadcasted at TV at midnight 15 years ago and has never been in theaters here. So we rescue this film and we make 3-4 projections, and one of the projections will be with the producer. You know, a lot of theaters are closing. The middle theaters are closing. You know, 4 or 5 screens, between 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 screens. I was observing, statistics in Spain. And the one screen theaters, they shut down, but now they are stabilized. But the others, I mean, the extra big multiplex, like more than 20, 25, they're also very going up. But then they are stabilized. So it's like kind of extremes are on and middle, they it seems to be difficult to in Spain. The point of going to a place and just having the same feeling, so sometimes you feel the theater is laughing or is, you know, afraid or at the same time, but with people you don't know, not your friends or your family, that's, for me, it's a kind of humanity at the pure sense, because you are feeling something together, but, well, you know, you don't know them. It's like going to a concert of music. There's a film from Jonas Trueba, who's a Madrilian filmmaker, Los Ilusos, that has been in La Cineteca in Madrid. And is a film who he produced by himself, absolutely, and he didn't want even to go to commercial theaters in Spain because he knows he's not interested. He preferred to go to some festivals or some cinematics. It's a film about people who make films in Madrid. They are a little bit bored and they start to make a film, and it's a kind of flavor of, you know, maybe a kind of French cinema of the 60s, end of the 60s, you know.
Esta exposición.
Tengo una amiga que dice que estar aquí es como estar en París.
Sinceramente creo que me ha devuelto el amor al cine.
Ojalá se disfrute.
With only one screen, Esteban's monthly program of films needs to be meticulously chosen. It requires a bit of intuition, and as he explains, it's quite a subjective process.
In Spain, there's something called estrenatitis. That means there's too many films to go to the theaters, and they keep out very good films very early because they bought maybe a, you know, very good film 4 times a day. The Thursday or later, they say, okay, it doesn't work because this kind of film, if you put it 4 times a day, of course, it's maybe not a good idea. You must just put it less times but more weeks. It's just that. I mean, we cross our fingers when I work, but we know that other theaters are working like this in Europe in particular.
For Monocle in Barcelona, I'm Lee Moldes.
The cinema is on Calle Beja in the Oster-Franks district of the city. And for more details, go to zoomzigscine.au. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. Join me again next week when I'll be talking Israeli TV with our pal Peter White and getting the lowdown on this year's Artissima Turin Art Fair. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher dusted off her wand again to conjure up a bit of audio magic for us. Time for one final song this week, ending the show. Here she is again, one final time. Here's Thijs Gulin. Thanks for tuning in.
No fondo do peito esse fruto apodrecendo a cada dentada. Mãe, no fondo do peito esse fruto apodrecendo a cada dentada. Abre um pátio abandonado. Tem 12 quartos fechados. Profetas nos corredores. Mortos embaixo da escada. Janela sozinha, olhar a cidade.